in an office episode I had written but was unavailable, and whose name I wrote down on a post-it note vowing to one day cast him in something. And Aubrey Plaza, who, fact number 19, had herself just arrived in LA when we were casting the show and happened to appear in the office of our casting director, Allison Jones, who called me on the phone and said, "I just met the weirdest 22-year-old woman I've ever seen. I think she's really special." And an hour later, Aubrey met with me and the other producers, and we thought she was hilarious and immediately wrote her into the show. And, fact number 20, so on and so on and so on. Do you see now why I like to make a sacrifice to the gods of luck? My own abilities and work ethic notwithstanding, my actual journey through Hollywood is a goddamn Jenga tower of luck. That list of good fortune I just laid out doesn't include a thousand other things that broke right for me at various times in my life. They're countless. I think about them all the time. I also think about what my life would be if I had been born somewhere else at another moment in another body with fewer opportunities. About how, in many crucial ways, I have played this video game on the easiest setting. And what I take from that is that I can't just lose a couple hundred bucks in Vegas to pay off my debt to the gods of luck. It means that my moral requirements on a day-to-day basis are far greater than average. I owe more to most people than they do to me. Now, that doesn't mean unlucky people get to run wild through the streets doing whatever they want. We should always remember that there is a baseline of morality, some combination of calculations based on virtue ethics, consequentialism, deontology, and so on, that everyone must adhere to. But it does mean that the higher up the scale we go with respect to good fortune and wealth and status, and thus freedom to move about the world without fear or pain, the higher the ethical standard is to which we should adhere. People are not all the same, but all people are subject to forces beyond their control, and different people benefit or suffer from those forces to different degrees. A just society accounts for the fact that people can't choose the context into which they're born or the random winds that buffet them once they arrive. All of which makes me think of John Rawls. The Veil of Ignorance. Let's level this playing field a little. John Rawls was a political philosopher and ethicist whose work drew heavily from Kant and Mill, and he was a friend and colleague of T.M. Scanlon. His most famous work is a 600-page beast called A Theory of Justice from 1971. Sometime in the 1960s, Rawls finished a much shorter first version and then showed it to a bunch of colleagues and students who gave him extensive notes and feedback, which apparently he incorporated all of because woof is this thing long. But justice does contain one of my favorite ethical ideas, which is easily understood, the veil of ignorance. When kids want to split something, like a piece of cake or a pile of M&Ms or whatever, parents will often tell one kid she can divide it into parts, but give the other kid the first choice. The veil of ignorance is essentially this idea, but presented more thoroughly. Rawls says that we ought to decide the rules for our society from what he calls the original position, meaning, ideally, we would all decide how we would divvy up things like salaries and resources for our society before we knew which role we were going to play in that society. We would conceive of these rules from behind what he calls a veil of ignorance regarding who we're all going to become. It's like deciding what the rules will be for grown-up humans back when we're all embryos. This, he says, guarantees a decently just world and further guarantees that we will all think of it as just. As he writes, quote, "Certain principles of justice are justified because they would be agreed to in an initial situation of equality," end quote. So, let's say we're about to start a society, one that, like all societies, will have limited resources and capital. And today, we're going to establish salary ranges for a bunch of jobs. Truck drivers, mechanics, baseball players, nurses, and teachers. But this society is some kind of cool science fiction society, where once we've established all the rules, we walk through a magic portal and emerge on the other side with a set of talents, and therefore a likely career, that will be randomly assigned to us. So it's possible that we'll become a baseball player, but it's more likely that we'll become a nurse or a teacher simply because there will be more of them than baseball players. The portal, in other words, is luck. It will stamp us with abilities, qualities, and life circumstances that we have no control over, like height, ethnicity, intelligence, hand-eye coordination, bagpipe playing ability, and a million other things. When designing societal guidelines for how we pay and treat people of different professions, then, we might think the following. A. We could end up being a baseball player. That would be amazing. Baseball players' talents are rare and desirable, so we should make sure that baseball players' potential salaries are high. But also, B. We're more likely to end up being a mechanic or a nurse or a teacher, so we should ensure that the minimum salaries for those jobs aren't so low that they end up miserable. And C. Also, we might want to ensure that the laws governing our society provide ample resources for schools and hospitals and the like, because if we're a teacher and our school has no money, we'll be bummed out. Since there's only so much money and capital to go around, we won't allow any one profession or sector of society to drain too many of our resources. We can see how Rawls's work is a close cousin of Scanlon's, right? Instead of proposing rules for our world that no reasonable person could reject, Rawls wants to propose them before we're out in the world, walking around and doing stuff. Because if we make rules before we know what we'll all become, we will all surely agree to them. Behind the veil of ignorance, we will all immediately realize that there's no way for any of us to gain an upper hand here. No one can know any more or less about what any one of us will become when we go through the portal. Scanlon, as Pamela Hieronymy pointed out to me, took that idea of symmetry and just shifted it later in the process. His reasonable people formulation asks that all of us engage in a similar kind of symmetry after we've metaphorically walked through the portal and learned what our lives are like. His version is more optimistic because it suggests that we can equate our own lives and needs and desires with everyone else's after we've already been living our lives, meaning that people who have led good and/or lucky lives will recognize that they need to be empathetic toward those who have been less fortunate. But honestly, Rawls's version would likely be more effective if it were possible in some kind of cool science fiction universe due to that exact reality we've discussed in this chapter. People who are successful are often overly invested in the idea that they and they alone are responsible for that success and are sometimes ignorant to or unwilling to allow for the important role that luck has played in their lives. So, this isn't utilitarianism, where individuals are coagulated and flattened out into one big, indistinguishable mass of happiness or pain. In Rawls's world, before we know what job we're going to have or what set of abilities we'll be assigned, we allow for and accept the inevitable differences in talent and societal value of the theoretical professions we might be assigned. In other words, after we move through this portal, we retain our integrity as individuals. We acknowledge that some people will be better than others at certain skills that are more highly valued by our society, and thus that some jobs will pay better than others, and we're okay with that. But we also take luck into account. The magic portal thingy means that we don't control what we become, so we set a high enough floor for everyone that means nobody will end up suffering due only to the caprices of luck. As Rawls puts it, quote, "No one should be advantaged or disadvantaged by natural fortune or social circumstances in the choice of the principles. It also seems widely agreed that it should be impossible to tailor principles to the circumstances of one's own case," end quote. In Rawls's scenario, we divide up the pile of M&Ms, but since the universe decides who gets which portion, we're gonna divide it somewhat equally. Rawls had essentially the same beef with utilitarianism that Bernard Williams did. As Rawls phrased it, utilitarianism, quote, "does not take seriously the distinction between persons," end quote. He wasn't interested in trying to maximize overall happiness in the world as it stands, but rather wanted to design a society that every member would theoretically sign up for with the comfort of knowing that it would be relatively just. That world could reward the Tom Hankses and Serena Williamses among us by allowing them to be appropriately compensated and celebrated, but never at the expense of teachers or postal workers or nurses or auto mechanics or anyone else. And though Rawls doesn't deal with this aspect much, I like to imagine another benefit. The Tom Hankses and Serena Williamses would always acknowledge the incredible portal-based fortune that allowed them to become what they are, no matter how much natural talent they were born with or hard work they put into developing it. Remember the portal. Let's take Rawls and Frank on a quick jaunt back to that question from Chapter 4. Do we have to return our shopping cart to the rack? When we're faced with one of these mundane questions, after we apply contractualist rules or seek a golden mean or follow a Kantian maxim or do all of these things in whatever combination we see fit, we need to remember one final thing. If we can even afford to be asking what we should do here, it probably means we're pretty lucky people. We have a car full of groceries and thus a functioning car, and the luxury of posing philosophical questions instead of having to think only about our health or safety or where we're going to find our next meal. If we determine that relative to other people we are lucky, which means we can afford to do a little extra, then we should do a little extra. And I don't mean Warren Buffett lucky, just lucky enough that we're able to do something to make other people's lives a bit easier at little or no real cost to our own. There are billions of people for whom that is not the case, so we have a duty to pick up the slack. Do a bit more than we're ethically required to do. Pay back the gods of luck. And if we're not lucky, if life has dealt us a series of blows that mean our internal batteries are running at 1% and we're barely scraping by, well, we fall back on those contractualist rules. We do whatever we can to address the minimum amount we owe to each other. We're almost at the end of our journey. We've learned what we're doing, why we're doing it, whether we could be doing something better, and why it would be better. We are flourishing like ethical rock stars over here. But we've also screwed up a lot. Now, we knew that would happen. The inevitable outcome of a life of caring and trying is a never-ending stream of screw-ups, great and small. So there's one last thing we have to do, and it stinks. We have to apologize.
Chapter 13. I screwed up. Do I have to say I'm sorry?
Anyone with kids will recognize this scene, which plays out in my home once a week.
Mom, he yanked the remote out of my hand and he won't give it back.
She wasn't even using it.
You can't just yank things out of people's hands. It's not okay to do that.
Fine, here.
Say you're sorry. Come on, say you're sorry. Apologize. We can stand here as long as you want, but you have to say you're sorry.
They stand there as long as kid number two wants. Minutes go by, then hours. Day turns to night. No one eats. Phones ring and go unanswered. Somewhere in the distance, a lone wolf howls. The sands of time slowly fall through the hourglass. Civilizations are made and unmade. Forests rise and then burn to ash, a reminder of the only true constant in the universe, change itself. And then, finally,
sorry.
Doing something wrong hurts. It stinks. It's embarrassing. But apologizing can hurt more and stink more and be more embarrassing. Feeling private guilt is one thing. Apologizing compounds that guilt with the shame of a public admission. But tempting though it is to avoid that shame after we screw up, apologizing is the final ascent on the mountain we have to climb in order to become better people. It's the punctuation mark on the end of an Aristotelian sentence that describes our search for virtue. It's an easily formulated Kantian maxim, a utilitarian happiness increaser, and a contractualist debt we can pay off all in one. Without an apology, the wound of a moral wrong can't completely heal. But It stinks. But we gotta do it. But it stinks. Part of the trouble with apologizing is that all we can think about in the moments leading up to the act itself is the awkward, halting mortification of admitting fault in front of other people. The good parts, the healing and growth and resolution, are harder to see. Apologies are not ethical actions per se, but I feel like they're ethics adjacent. If caring and trying are the key to ethical improvement and failure is the inevitable result, apologies are like an exit interview for that failure. What did we do? Why did we do it? What did we learn about how it affected other people? The ickiness that we feel when we apologize, that flush-faced shame that comes from admitting fault to a person that we've wronged, is actually good. It means that we feel the pain that we've caused and we care that we caused it. A person incapable of shame, said Aristotle, has no sense of disgrace. So those feelings are like flu symptoms. It's our bodies working to cure what ails us. But because apologies are so fraught with that ickiness, people as a whole are terrible at them. Like anything else, there are good and bad versions of apologies. If we're going to take a deep breath, confront our fear of shame, and actually make one, we ought to do it right. In 1985, Tom Petty did a concert tour for his album Southern Accents, whose stage design featured a huge Confederate battle flag. Years later, after many people had pointed out to him what that flag represents, he said this in Rolling Stone.
The Confederate flag was the wallpaper of the South when I was a kid growing up in Gainesville, Florida. I always knew it had to do with the Civil War, but the South had adopted it as its logo. I was pretty ignorant of what it actually meant. It was on a flagpole in front of the courthouse, and I often saw it in Western movies. I just honestly didn't give it much thought, though I should have. It left me feeling stupid. That's the word I can use. I felt stupid. If I had just been a little more observant about things going on around me, it wouldn't have happened. I still feel bad about it. I've just always regretted it. When Southerners wave that flag, they aren't stopping to think how it looks to a black person. I blame myself for not doing that. It was dumb, and it shouldn't have happened.
I love this statement. It's clear and straightforward. He doesn't dig in his heels or make excuses. Instead, he just explains how it happened, acknowledges that he blew it, names the people he hurt, and expresses regret. This is the correct way to apologize. If you were a person who felt pain because a popular rock star validated a symbol of hate, and then, even years later, you saw this statement, that pain might dissipate. Now, let's swing on over to the other kind of apology. In July of 2020, Representative Ted Yoho accosted his colleague, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, on the steps of the Capitol and called her, among other things, a fucking bitch. Pressured to apologize, Yoho took to the floor of Congress and said this.
I rise to apologize for the abrupt manner of the conversation I had with my colleague from New York. It is true that we disagree on policies and visions for America, but that does not mean we should be disrespectful.
Okay, so far so good. I mean, I don't think you were asked to apologize for the abrupt manner of the conversation as much as the actual words you said, but we will give you the benefit of the doubt.
Having been married for 45 years with two daughters, I'm very cognizant of my language. The offensive name-calling words attributed to me by the press were never spoken to my colleagues. And if they were construed that way, I apologize for the misunderstanding.
Uh-oh. Anytime someone who claims to be apologizing for something drags his wife and kids into the mix for no reason, alarm bells should go off. I can't be a bad person because someone loves me, and also I'm a parent. The most popular recent version of this, I have a family defense, involves men speaking about other men's sexual assaults or offensive language toward women, and citing the fact that because they have daughters or wives or mothers, they find those behaviors offensive. This, of course, implies that they wouldn't really find the behavior offensive if they were single and had no female children. If you ever hear someone say, as the father of a daughter, just walk away. The rest of that sentence is ethical gobbledygook. Also, it's not really an apology if you deny the incident in question even happened. I mean, if it didn't happen, why apologize? And finally, if they were construed that way, how exactly should Ocasio-Cortez have construed the phrase fucking bitch? Jocular, good-natured ribbing? But, all right, keep going, Congressman, I guess, and let's see if we can't get this train back on track.
My wife Carolyn and I started together at the age of 19 with nothing.
Nope, it's more off track now. The wheels are coming loose, the dashboard is flashing red warning signals, and there's ominous smoke pouring out of the engine.
We did odd jobs, and we were on food stamps. I know the face of poverty, and for a time, it was mine.
Ted, buddy, why are we getting into your financial history? You're apologizing to someone, remember?
That is why I know people in this country can still, with all its faults, rise up and succeed and not be encouraged to break the law.
All right, I'm lost now. What are you even doing here, guy? Which people? Who was encouraged to break a law? What law? What are you even talking about?
I will commit to each of you that I will conduct myself from a place of passion and understanding, that policy and political disagreement be vigorously debated with the knowledge that we approach the problems facing our nation with the betterment of the country in our mind and the people we serve.
Woof, that is one tortured sentence. That sounds like he typed, "I will commit," and then just kept hitting the auto-predict text button. And finally, at the end, he sticks a nonsensical toothpick into this gibberish sandwich.
I cannot apologize for my passion or for loving my God, my family, and my country.
So, to sum up, I'm here to apologize, but I won't apologize. I didn't do the thing you think I did because you construed it wrong. At one point I was poor, and I won't apologize for loving God and America. Yo-ho out. This is a very bad apology. He barely acknowledged the person he was apologizing to. He denied the event occurred. He brought up being on food stamps for some reason. And then he self-righteously refused to apologize for his awesome qualities, which no one had asked him to do. This is plainly not an apology. It is, and I swear this is an actual philosophical term, bullshit. This is the part where there's a lot of cursing, for a good reason. Harry G. Frankfurt is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Princeton University. He has also taught at Yale, been a visiting fellow at All Souls College at Oxford, received grants from the Guggenheim and Mellon Foundations, and written an entire book about bullshit. Specifically, On Bullshit, a paper he published in 1986 that was released in adorably small book form in 2005. It became something of a phenomenon, landing on the New York Times bestseller list for 27 weeks, presumably because, as he notes in its opening sentence, quote, "One of the most salient features of our culture is that there is so much bullshit." Frankfurt aims to distinguish bullshit from lying. Here's what he writes.
Telling a lie is an act with a sharp focus. It is designed to insert a particular falsehood at a specific point in a set or system of beliefs in order to avoid the consequences of having that point occupied by the truth.
In other words, a liar knows the truth and deliberately speaks in opposition to it. A bullshitter, however, is, quote, "unconstrained by a concern with truth," end quote. The bullshitter couldn't care less what the truth is. He wants only to make himself appear a certain way or achieve some effect on the listener. Frankfurt imagines, for example, a puffed-up, rah-rah American giving a 4th of July speech and bombastically celebrating the founders, the flag, mom, and apple pie. It's immaterial what this guy actually thinks about America, says Frankfurt. He may truly love the country, he might hate it, he might be indifferent. That's not the point. The point is this.
The orator intends these statements to convey a certain impression of himself. He is not trying to deceive anyone concerning American history. What he cares about is what people think of him.
The bullshitter has only one goal: to make the listener think of him as a certain kind of person, whether it be a patriot, a moral avatar, a sensitive and caring soul, or whatever else advances his personal interests. There's an excellent essay from the original Gawker.com called On Smarm by the writer Tom Skoka, which uses Frankfurt's essay to make its point. Skoka locates smarm alongside bullshit this way, quote, "Smarm is a kind of performance, an assumption of the forms of seriousness, of virtue, of constructiveness, without the substance. Smarm is concerned with appropriateness and with tone. Smarm disapproves. Smarm would rather talk about anything other than smarm. Why, smarm asks, can't everyone just be nicer?" End quote. Both the smarmmeister and the bullshitter have a goal in mind that ignores the actual issue at hand. The smarmmeister pretends to take offense at the tone or incivility of his accuser, while the bullshitter just waves his hand and spews words indiscriminately to achieve the effect he's after. Frankfurt puts it this way, quote, "The essence of bullshit is not that it is false, but that it is phony," end quote. Representative Yoho was caught doing something bad, accosting and cursing at a woman he works with who had committed the unforgivable crime of not sharing his political stances. When he was caught, the right thing to do was to apologize. Instead, he delivered a line of bullshit intended to make other people, his political allies and not the woman he cursed at, see him a certain way. This is not a partisan phenomenon. Contemporary Republicans may have raised it to an art form, but the history of political oratory reveals heaping mounds of bullshit from both sides of the aisle. Another classic disingenuous apology move, which Yoho employed a version of, is to say, "I'm sorry if you were offended," which of course is less an apology than an accusation. That's saying both "I did nothing wrong" and "You're so dumb you thought I did something wrong and got upset, so I'm sorry that you're so dumb." Apologies don't undo whatever bad thing we did, but when they're sincere and honestly delivered, they can help heal the wound. They won't do anything, however, if we're defensive or hedging or disingenuous, if what we offer is not actually a sincere plea for forgiveness. Our resistance to one-on-one apologies carries over to the larger sphere of institutional or governmental ones. Periodically, some people will call for American state apologies for this nation's large-scale past horrors, like the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, or slavery, or the Native American genocide. The counterargument amounts to, "That was a long time ago. What's done is done. Get over it." I find this argument lacking. National sins require national apologies, no matter how long ago they were committed. These apologies can take the form of a simple declaration, or far better, a declaration and actual restitution paid to the descendants of those who suffered. But the first step is the simple admission of wrongdoing. In 1992, Pope John Paul II apologized on behalf of his predecessor for a mistake made by the Catholic Church. The notable thing about this was that the man he apologized to was Galileo, and the mistake had been made in 1633. Galileo had confirmed the Copernican theory of the universe, which posited that the Earth revolved around the sun and not vice versa. And for that, he was called a heretic and threatened with imprisonment and death and everything else the church could throw at him. Ultimately, his fame earned him a mere house arrest, which was conditional on his recanting his findings. Galileo did indeed recant because, you know, he didn't want to die. And as the story goes, he then muttered under his breath, "Eppur si muove," which means, "And yet it moves," it being Earth. This is super badass that he muttered this under his breath in front of a potentially murderous pope, and it makes me think that Galileo was a cool dude. Almost 360 years later, Pope John Paul said, in essence, "Our bad." Now, admittedly, he did hedge a bit by saying that the Catholic Church was merely working with the information they had at the time, but he apologized, and it mattered. He resolved the open cadence of this historical wrong, and when institutions do that, it declares once and for all that they are fallible, and that they owe something to those they've wronged. If instead of apologizing, the Pope had said, "We never did this, and historians are wrong, and also, the Church has done a bunch of good charitable work, and we'll never apologize for our faith in God," well, that wouldn't be an apology. That would be, well, you know, you get it. People ought to apologize when they screw up. So should politicians and religious institutions and countries. Apologizing matters. I say this as a person who has failed to apologize for countless mistakes I've made in my life. My age 40-ish journey into moral philosophy caused me many sleepless nights, mostly due to the realization that I have hurt people and never told them I'm sorry for having done so. If we're lucky enough to live on this planet for more than a couple of years, we are condemned to cause damage to people we love, people we don't even know, and everyone in between. Only recently have I fully understood the inevitability of that, or the fact that when we inevitably do it, we have one move left. Suck it up and say we're sorry. And do it sooner rather than later. Waiting 359 years to apologize takes away some of the impact. I have one final question to ask in a book full of them, but this one is easy to answer. What do we hope will happen when we apologize? When we face our fear of embarrassment, brave the shame and flushed face and shaky voice, and admit our wrongdoing? We simply hope that whoever we've wronged will recognize our sincere regret and our desire to be a little better today than we were yesterday. We hope for whatever mix of kindness, empathy, grace, and understanding leads people to say, "It's okay," even if they're still mad at us, even if we lied to them when we knew we shouldn't have, or told them to wear a zebra print fedora to an office holiday party to disastrous results. We hope for forgiveness. So here, near the end of our journey, is where the rubber of ethics meets the rough road of everyday life with all of its messiness and complexity. We have said over and over that caring about what we do requires us to accept and endure a lifetime of screwing up, getting it wrong, hurting people. Sometimes the bad we do will be minuscule, barely a tenth of one dolor floating off into the universe, hardly noticed and largely unimportant. Sometimes it'll be far, far worse, a real pain felt in a real way by some number of people whose lives have been made markedly worse because of something we did. It is right and appropriate to speak up in the right way, at the right times, in the right amount, when people fall short of virtue and cause some pain or suffering. But if they've done something forgivable, we should remember what we hope for when we screw up and try to summon that same grace and understanding. Now, what does forgivable mean, you might ask? That is a deeply complicated philosophical question that would take a whole other book to answer, and honestly, I'm not sure Todd has the patience to put up with me for another 2 years. The point is this. To demand perfection, or to hold people to impossible standards, is to deny the simple and beautiful reality that nobody is perfect.
Coda. Okay, kids, what have we learned?
Dear Ivy and William, parents and moral philosophers, I have come to learn, are annoying in exactly the same way. Both groups spend their lives thinking about what makes a person good and trying to convince other people to buy into their theories. For the philosophers, those other people are everyone on the planet, but for parents, mostly, it's their kids. So you had the misfortune to be born to a parent who's also into moral philosophy. It's a real double whammy. Twice the theories and twice as many attempts at convincing you to listen. But bear with me just for a few minutes here as I try to summarize why I care about this stuff and why you should too. Right after Ivy was born, I took a walk with your grandmother and I marveled at how many new things I had to worry about. You worry about one set of things when they're babies and then another set of things when they're toddlers, I remember saying. And now I can imagine worrying about them as kindergartners and middle schoolers and so on. Nana said nothing. I guess that's just the deal with parenthood, I continued, working it out for myself. You worry and worry and worry until they're finally grown-ups and have jobs and stuff. Oh, it doesn't get any better when they're grown-ups, said Nana. I worry about you all the time. So far, she's been proven right. As I write this, William is 12 and Ivy is 10, and not a day has gone by that your mom and I haven't worried about you. Sometimes it's because of what you've done or not done, like when William, taking after his mom, gets way too angry when he loses at ping pong, or when Ivy, taking after her dad, decides the best response to any kind of conflict is to just go completely silent. Other times, I worry because the world you're inheriting feels impossible to navigate, even for the very luckiest humans alive, a group you two belong to. And if it feels impossible for you to navigate, if its problems and threats and moral tangles present a path so treacherous that no parent in the world would wish to see her child try to walk it, what that parent is left with is worry. But if Montesquieu was right, and knowledge makes people gentle, maybe it makes them safer, too. That's the bet I'm making, really. I'm placing a decent-sized bet on the idea that understanding morality and following its compass during decisions great and small will make you better, and therefore safer. Not safer from harm, necessarily, although I hope for that, too, but from all of the traps that modern life sets, especially for people lucky enough to be born into privilege. I'm talking about selfishness, callousness, cruelty, hypocrisy, snobbery, all of those qualities that people display when they decide we are not actually living all together here on Earth, but instead are living alone, individually, 8 billion siloed ego states, competing with each other in a race that they seem to forget inevitably ends with everyone in a dead heat. So far, I think you're good people. You understand right and wrong, and you generally try to do right. You're kind to your friends, and when you're not, you feel bad and sometimes apologize. Your virtue starter kits arrived intact. You also understand how very lucky we are, and as often as your mom and I grill you on your understanding of this luck, you're not likely to forget about it. But just understanding the concept of good fortune isn't enough. The world moves fast. And it wouldn't take much for you to forget the role luck has played in your lives, which could lead to you feeling entitled to things and tossing your moral compasses aside in favor of an inflexible response to the questions you face. It might lead you to do only what you want, without asking yourself some simple questions. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? Is there something I could be doing that's better? And why is it better? You wonder what your mom and I worry about? It's that. And climate change. We also worry about climate change. But here's the good news. A lot of very smart people have been thinking about these problems, how to be good, how we should act, what we owe to each other, for a very long time. They have ideas for how we might avoid disappearing into our own little worlds. Though their ideas vary widely, they're all based on the simple concept that who we are and what we do matters. That we should care whether we're doing something good or not, and thus try to do the best things we can. And if you can get past the fact that the people who formulated these ideas wrote super confusing books that will give you an instant headache, you can someday arm yourselves with their ideas, use them when you make decisions, and become the kind of people that would let your mom and me stop worrying all the time about whether you're okay, or at least worry less. I've tried to explain a few of their ideas in this book so you can have something to refer to as you get older, passing through all the strange and unsettling eras of life, each of which will twist you into knots and garble your brains in ways you didn't expect. One of the great ironies of aging is that every 10 years or so, you look back on the person that you were 10 years before and shudder at the mistakes you made, at your immaturity and thick-headedness, and then you breathe a sigh of relief that you're so much smarter and more mature now. And then, 10 years later, it happens again. I'm 46, and I can only guess which of my current actions will embarrass me 10 years from now. Hopefully, one of them won't be writing this book. So I very much hope that this book will benefit you someday. But right now, you're 12 and 10, and even a casual discussion of the categorical imperative might be kind of a hard sell. Your mom and I did not take the same approach to your education that John Stuart Mill's dad did with his kid, which means you didn't learn Greek and Latin in kindergarten, but also you don't hate us and aren't horribly depressed, which we think is a good trade-off. So here, at the end, I'm going to tell you in simple terms what I think matters. Think of this as the quick start guide to this whole project. It won't cover everything, but it'll be a decent starting point. You are people on Earth. You are not alone here, and that means you owe the other people on Earth certain things. What you owe them, more or less, is to live by rules they wouldn't reject as unfair, assuming that they're decent, reasonable people. So if you, Ivy, are about to do something and you're not sure whether it's okay, ask yourself if William would tell you it's a good idea. William, ask yourself if Ivy would say the same thing. And then keep going. Ask yourself if one of your friends would reject it as a bad idea, or one of your teachers, or even a kid you don't like that much, but who you have to admit is pretty smart. If you feel like those people could reasonably reject your idea for what to do, maybe don't do it. Maybe do something else. Or you can try this. You can think to yourself before you do something, would it be okay if everyone did this? What would the world be like if every single person were allowed to do whatever I'm about to do? If that world seems twisted or unfair or nonsensical, you should probably do something else. Or think about what you're about to do and imagine the result. Think about how many people will be happy and how many sad, and how happy or sad they will be. Think about how soon they'll be sad or happy, and for how long they will be sad or happy. Try to total it all up in your mind and think about whether what you're about to do will result in more total sadness or happiness. This one is tricky, but sometimes it's the best way to find an answer. And while you are here on Earth, think about the parts of people you love, their kindness, generosity, loyalty, courage, determination, mildness. Aim yourselves at the exact right amount of those qualities as best you can, not too much and not too little. And know that you're often going to get it wrong. You'll try to be mild, let's say, and you won't be mild enough, and then you'll overcompensate and become too mild, and that'll keep happening, and it will annoy people, and that will sting. But hopefully, by just trying over and over, you'll get closer and closer to getting it right. The trying is important. Keep trying. Over the course of your lives, you may find yourself drawn more or less toward one or another of these techniques for determining right from wrong and good from bad. That's fine. Use the ones you like, the ones that make sense to you, but keep the others around just in case. There will be moments when you're befuddled, when the system you put in place to guide you seems to fail, when you're caught red-handed defending one thing while condemning another thing, and you'll come to see that contradiction as inconsistent. It'll be embarrassing. You may have to draw and redraw the lines between good and bad over and over, and that's fine. The important thing is that you keep drawing them. Almost done. I promise. I can feel you getting annoyed. But I need to say just a little bit more about other people. Humans have this problem. We're kind of trapped inside our own brains. Our default setting is to think about ourselves, how to keep ourselves happy and safe and protected. Now, sometimes that's good. We have integrity, which means, in this case, a sense of wholeness, of being undivided. If someone asks you to do something that doesn't seem like it fits with who you are or how you think of yourself, a little voice in your head might start chirping at you, warning you that this doesn't feel right. Don't ignore that voice. It's there to help. But being trapped inside our own brains also means that sometimes we don't think enough about other people. If you were growing up in South Africa or Zimbabwe, you might have been taught to live through other people, to think of their happiness as your happiness, their pain as your pain. But you are growing up in America. And America, like a lot of other places, teaches people to look out for themselves first. There's even a very famous writer who told people that selfishness was actually good, that the more selfish everyone is, the better the world will be. I know, it's bonkers. She was a very silly person and an impressively terrible writer. And so, being raised in America, you need to start thinking about other people a little more. Sometimes, that will be really hard. It'll take work, concentration, energy, sacrifice. It'll be tricky and complex and confusing. These are the times you'll blow it. You will make a mistake and cause harm you did not intend to cause. Take a deep breath and apologize. Remember, we are wrong all the time. We are wrong and we try again and we're wrong again and again and again. Keep trying. Choosing to not try is still making a choice, and it won't make you or anyone else a better person. Thousands of years ago, in a part of Greece called Delphi, some people built a temple. They were worried about their kids, too. All parents in history have been worried about their kids. It's not just mom and me. So they chiseled a couple of sayings into a column of that temple to tell their kids and their grandkids and their great-grandkids in as few words as possible how to try to pull off the nearly impossible task of living a good life on Earth. Here's what they wrote. Know thyself and nothing in excess. Honestly, as far as guides to life go, I don't think anyone has beaten that in the 2,400 years since. Know thyself. Think about who you are. Check in with yourself when you do things to see if you've made good decisions. Remember what you value and care about. Understand your integrity and live a life consistent with that integrity. Nothing in excess. Because too much or too little of anything will screw you up. Practice virtues like kindness and generosity and courage, but not too much of them. Drink whiskey when you're old enough, but don't drink too much whiskey. And single malt, by the way, none of that blended junk. Watch TV, but don't watch too much TV. Don't eat too many tacos or exercise too much or curse too much. That's one that I struggle with. Somewhere in the middle of every kind of virtue you can have and everything you do, there's a perfect amount of that thing, and your job is to find it. You want a real quick start guide for how to live a good life? A guide so pithy you can have it tattooed on your arm with plenty of room to spare? Know thyself, nothing in excess. There's more, of course. You can't just use that, but maybe start there. Being a good person is a job, and a hard one at that. But if you care about it, it may start to seem less like work and more like a puzzle that you can solve. And in those rare times when you have to make a decision and you assemble the pieces in exactly the right way, so the image of what to do comes sharply into focus, you will feel alive and fulfilled and elated. You will feel like you're flourishing, which is really all Mom and I hope for you. We want you to be safe from harm and from the pitfalls of the specific lives you're leading. We want you to be happy, not in the eating pizza with your friends way, but in a deeper, more lasting way. We want you to be good, to act with good intentions, to cause minimal harm to those around you, to abide by rules you'd want everyone to follow and that other people wouldn't reject as unfair. We want you to apologize when you screw up, and we want you to try to do better the next time. Doing all of these things can help you flourish to be the very best versions of yourselves. But again, there will be plenty of times when you do not flourish, when you straight up blow it. And then you'll try again, and you'll blow it again, over and over, and you will be frustrated and you'll feel awful. And if you've tried to do something good 1,000 times, and you have failed 1,000 times, and the people around you are miserable, and you're at the end of your rope, and you're losing faith in yourselves, do you know what we want you to do then? Keep trying. Keep trying. Keep trying. Love, Dad. Acknowledgements. Let's be honest. No one listens to this part unless you are a person who thinks you might have been thanked, which means you're either listening to it to hear your name or else to not hear your name so that you can get righteously angry that I forgot to thank you. If that's the case, I am legitimately sorry. If I did thank you, then congrats on hearing your name. It's cool to hear your name in an audiobook. If you are neither a person I thanked nor a person I should have thanked but forgot to, and for some reason you're listening to this part, I am going to try to make it more interesting by stirring cool little facts and anecdotes into the acknowledgments every so often. For example, there are more than 1 quadrillion ants on Earth. 1 million billion ants? That's so many ants. This book simply doesn't happen without the wisdom, knowledge, and all-around good spirit of Todd May. He encouraged me, supported the vision of the book unconditionally, and patiently explained the nuances of various versions of existentialism 700 times until I finally felt confident enough to write that chapter. Thank you, Todd, for everything. Sorry about all the commas. Todd hates commas. Pamela Hieronymy not only kickstarted my understanding of moral philosophy, she also volunteered to read the first chunk of this book and give me notes, which, I've come to understand, is the academic philosopher equivalent of helping someone move into a sixth floor walk-up. Her notes were invaluable. Thank you, Pamela. If you ever need me to help you move, just say the word. And sorry, I occasionally forget and call you Pam. Albert Einstein once used a $1,500 check, which is roughly $30,000 in today's money, for a bookmark, and then couldn't remember where he put the book. And once at a dinner party, his wife mistook a bouquet of orchids for a salad and ate them. Eamon Dolan from Simon & Schuster provided the perfect combination of editorial acumen, congeniality, tough love, and disdain for the phrase sort of. He steered a first-time author through the choppy waters of self-doubt with a steady, friendly demeanor that I appreciated greatly. Thank you, Eamon. Sorry I left in all those likes and gottas. A whole lot of people at Simon & Schuster and elsewhere had to read this thing 1 million times and make sure it wasn't all messed up, or write me 1 million emails to ensure I wasn't messing it up in some other way. Most notably, Laura Cherkis, Zipporah Bache, and Kaylee Hoffman. Thank you, and I'm sorry that you had to read this 1 million times. Kate Canast expertly fact-checked the whole thing, and any remaining mistakes are certainly my fault and not hers. In December of 1997, I signed with 3Arts Management, mostly because of all the agents and managers I had met, David Miner seemed like the nicest and funniest. 25 years later, every move I make in my career starts with a phone call either to or from him. I am eternally grateful for all 25 of those years. And our partnership is what led me to Richard Abate, who got exactly what this book wanted to be and knew exactly how to present it to publishers. I should also thank Ken Richman, Matt Rice, and Julian Twan, whose guidance and advice are a big part of the Jenga Tower of Luck that is my writing career. Here's a fun riddle for kids. A wealthy man dies and leaves his collection of elephants to his 3 children. To his oldest, he leaves half of his elephants. To his middle kid, he leaves 1/3 of his elephants. And to his youngest, he leaves 1/9 of his elephants. The problem is, he has 17 elephants. So the kids seek the advice of a wise woman in their town, and she instantly comes up with a solution. What is it? I will wait 2 seconds and then tell you. The wise woman adds 1 of her elephants to the herd to make a total of 18. So half of them, 9, go to the oldest kid, 1/3, 6, go to the middle kid, and 1/9, 2, go to the youngest. 9 plus 6 plus 2 is 17, and then the woman takes her elephant back, and everyone is happy. This comes from the book A Children's Almanac of Words at Play by Willard R. Espy, which was my favorite book when I was a kid. One of the most fun side effects of working on this book was that it brought me into contact with philosophers from all over the country. Dr. Molefe Kete-Asante from Temple lent me his expertise on the Ubuntu section. I'm also grateful to have made the acquaintance of T.M. Scanlon, who is exactly as charming and thoughtful in conversation as I imagined he would be. Craig Vassy from the North American Sartre Society invited Todd and me to speak at their annual gathering, which was delightful and I got a cool NASS pin that I wear with pride. I'm also grateful to Peter Singer and Isaac Martinez at Princeton and Megan Sullivan at Notre Dame for invitations to talk to them and their students about ethics. Of course, this book would never have been written at all if it weren't for The Good Place. Making that show was a joy from beginning to end. The conversations we had in that writer's room about philosophy, comedy, ethics, and a whole bunch of stuff that was far less important than philosophy, comedy, or ethics leave me forever indebted to that writing staff. Demi Adijuibe, Megan Amram, Chris Ensel, Kate Gersten, Cord Jefferson, Dave King, Andrew Law, Cassia Miller, Dylan Morgan, Aisha Muharrar, Matt Murray, Lizzie Pace, Rafat Sani, Dan Schofield, Josh Siegel, Jennifer Statsky, Tyler Stracely, and Alan Yang. Each of their senses of humor is in the show, which means they're all in this book. I love all of you weirdos, and I'm a better person for knowing you. Additional thanks to my assistant, Bridget Stinson, and all of the writer's assistants and PAs we had over the years for their tireless work, and to everyone who watched the show and got something out of it, which was the whole point of making it. Once, Samuel Beckett was walking with his friend in London on a beautiful spring day. His friend commented on how lovely the weather was and how nice it was to be walking with his old friend, and Beckett agreed. Then his friend said that it was days like this that made you glad to be alive. And Beckett replied, "Well, I wouldn't go that far." Over the course of the show, we had various guest lecturers come and discuss matters of ethics and social justice. In addition to Todd and Pamela, Joshua Green and DeRay McKesson were generous with their time and their words. Damon Lindelof wasn't really a guest lecturer per se, more of a spiritual advisor, but without his early advice, there may have been no show at all. The Good Place production team, headed by Morgan Sackett and David Hyman, made sure that the ideas that came out of the writer's room could be turned into actual entertainment. Most of what I've done in my TV career has really, actually, been done by them. The talented artists and craftspeople who put the show together are too numerous to mention. Naming one requires me to name them all. So please just know I am forever indebted to every one of you for your hard work. And then there are the actors and directors who took those thorny ideas and translated them for an audience. Most importantly, Ted Danson, Kristen Bell, Manny Jacinto, Jamila Jamil, Darcy Carden, William Jackson Harper, Mark Evan Jackson, and Drew Goddard. Boy, oh boy, do I love and miss you all. The word buffalo, written out 8 times in a row, creates a complete and grammatically correct sentence. I again thank my wife, J.J. Philbin, because she read this whole thing when I first finished a draft, and we both know exactly how annoying it is when someone asks you to read something they wrote, and in this case, it was like 250 pages longer than the usual kind of thing we have to read. I love you so much. Thank you for being my wife. The first person to read the entire manuscript outside of my immediate family was Dan Lebatard, whose thoughtful notes and general praise put wind into my sails. I have been a gainfully employed writer since 1997, thanks to the generosity and tutelage of countless people who gave me a shot or kept giving me shots when I didn't really deserve them, or taught me how to shoot better or just like the way I shoot enough to extend my shooting contract. Among them, John Stewart, Steve Higgins, Lauren Michaels, Mike Shoemaker, Tina Fey, Adam McKay, Bella Bajaria, Tracy Picosta, Perlina Ibakwe, Steve Burke, and Jeff Shell. Chief among them is Greg Daniels, a peerless writer and the greatest teacher I've ever had. Thank you, all of you, forever. Some Alaskan moose in the western Yukon have been observed having birthday parties for each other, complete with presents, usually smooth rocks or metal objects that they find in nature, and even birthday cakes made out of weeds and mud. They even sing a song to each other by grunting in unison. Now, it should be noted that I completely made this one up. Moose do not have birthday parties for each other. That's ridiculous, and frankly, it's embarrassing that you fell for that. Finally, there are just a whole bunch of writers, some of whom I know and some of whom I've never met, whose work has altered my brain chemistry in that way that only great writing can. Thank you all for spending your time writing comedy, fiction, nonfiction, plays, music, TV, movies, journalism, anything. Writing is a weird job, and I salute everyone who makes it her life's work. But I will end this acknowledgement section before I just start listing writers that I like. So thank you for listening to the book, or maybe just skipping ahead to this part of the audiobook to see if I thanked you.
How to Be Perfect: The Correct Answer to Every Moral Question was written by Michael Shure, with philosophical nitpicking by Professor Todd May. It was read by Michael Shure, with Kristen Bell, Darcy Carden, Ted Danson, William Jackson Harper, Manny Jacinto, Mark Evan Jackson, Jamila Jamil, and Professor Todd May, with a special appearance by Getty Lee. It was recorded by Austin Halterman and Charles Carroll at the Invisible Studios in West Hollywood, California, and by Charles de Montebello at CDM Sound Studios in New York City. Music by David Schwartz, mixed by Scott Shepard. Editing, mix, and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producers were Sophie Perrins, Alexandra Howdyshell, Joy Asukwo, and Claire Tadakoro. How to Be Perfect was produced and directed by Michael Noble. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. How to Be Perfect: The Correct Answer to Every Moral Question is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.